KUOW podcasts are made possible by listener support. Become a new or renewing member today at KUOW.org.
Who is the subject of the sentence? Whom is the object?
Right, well, it must have been them what did it.
It must have been they who did it!
Exactly!
Washington cannot continually operate under a cloud of crisis. That freezes up consumers. It gets businesses worried. We can't afford these self-inflicted wounds.
I think that we have to get to a place where we recognize that our children do not have D's or R's on them. And we've got to find a way to fund education in the state of Washington.
Today on Weekday, we're going to talk about grammar and see if the grammar police are issuing too many citations. That's coming up. Also, President Obama chastising Congress. We're going to talk about the sequester and what it might mean for Washington State again. And Highline School Superintendent Susan Enfield on funding education in the state of Washington. The big topic around Olympia. We're in week five of the state legislative session in Olympia. This week, legislators are tackling school construction issues, security and gun control, but they are also still looking at those larger questions of how to fund education and whether an expiring tax is a tax cut or not. Austin Jenkins is the Olympia correspondent for KUOW and many Northwest public radio stations. Hello, Austin.
Good morning, Steve.
It's good to talk to you again.
Likewise.
Why are they taking up questions of school construction in Olympia?
Well, this is unusual. This is part of the capital budget, which is, you know, bricks and mortar, building things. Usually the capital budget, the transportation budget, and the operating budget are all sort of done together. While they are separate budgets, they're kind of done together at the end of session. But this is clearly an effort on the part of the new Senate majority, these 23 Republicans and two Democrats, to make a very public statement that they are putting schools and education first. They're putting school security first. Embedded in this $500 million, if you will, for school construction is about $10 million to ensure that all schools have automatic alarms, direct alarms to police departments. So this is all part of a sort of positioning to say education is the paramount duty of the state, and the new majority hears that message loud and clear.
Well, let's get to that positioning in a moment. But one other thing that has popped up, and I know you've just been looking at it, expanding warrantless searches on school property. Who's supporting that, and how does this dovetail to what you just mentioned?
Well, obviously, school security is a front and center issue in state capitals across the country in 2013 because of the Newtown shooting. And so this, what's interesting about this warrantless school search is that it does have bipartisan support. There are Republican leads and some Democrats have signed on. It's not perhaps as radical as some might think it is to say that you can go into a school and search a student or a locker without a warrant. Essentially, right now, school officials have that authority. The question here is whether a school resource officer or a police officer can walk in and do the same. There was a Supreme Court decision that essentially said, tested this and said, no, school resource officer doesn't have the same authority to do a warrantless search that, say, a school principal does. So this essentially is putting into state law that authority for somebody wearing a badge and gun.
Is there anyone opposing this notion, any groups that are opposing this notion of warrantless searches?
Certainly from a civil libertarian standpoint, there are those who think that that this is an infringement on student rights, who see a difference between a school administrator who is not an authority with the power to arrest doing a search versus a police officer. And so, yeah, this is definitely controversial. What's interesting, again, to me is just, you know, one of the initial cues I always use looking at a bill is whether something has some bipartisan support. Reading tea leaves, trying to figure out the kind of gauge support and the interest for something like this, you see some bipartisan support and you think, well, maybe as part of a package of school safety measures, this is the kind of thing that you might see moving ahead through the process.
Austin Jenkins is with us from Olympia. Let me take a little side trip on security issues. What gun control legislation is the legislature taking up?
Well, it's been very interesting to see just in the last, I would say, 10 days, a shift on this issue between the House and the Senate. About 10 days ago, Jamie Peterson, state representative from Seattle, he's the chair of the House Judiciary Committee, introduced a universal background check for gun purchases bill. He did so with the support and the signature of Representative Mike Hope, who is represents Snohomish County but is a Seattle police officer. This came right after that gun turn-in buyback up in Seattle, where you are, Steve, and where there was basically a open-air gun market going on right next to that. And police officers, there was nothing they could do to step in. That was not illegal. This measure would basically say all gun sales, even person-to-person private sales, would be subject to a national background check. What's interesting is that when this bill was introduced, and I asked Senator Rodney Thom, the leader of this new majority in the Senate, about this, he said basically, he didn't answer the question whether he supported it, but he said, we're not looking for feel-good, soundbite solutions. And he said that these things are divisive and difficult. Now he has signed on to an basically identical bill that has 23 supporters in the state Senate. And that bill came out this week, and there's clearly, perhaps they're reading the polls that seem to support show that the public widely supports this idea, but there's been an absolute shift on that one issue in particular, and that to me suggests that it might have legs this session.
Now, you know, in the past, as you know, when gun issues come up, there's a strong lobbying force that turns out, often from gun control advocates, but also from gun rights supporters. The NRA is pretty strong in Washington State. What have you seen? What's been the on-the-ground indication of who's lobbying and how they're being received?
Lots of people with guns on the Capitol campus is the answer. I covered a rally a couple Saturdays ago, well attended by people who were openly carrying handguns, openly carrying military-style rifles across their backs. Very fired up speakers talking about encroachment on the Second Amendment. We saw a similar but smaller rally last Friday, also here in the Capitol campus. But these measures have not yet gotten hearings, and that will happen this Thursday in the House Judiciary Committee. And that's when you're going to start to see packed hearing rooms. I mean, this is an issue that gets people very emotional. So I anticipate that this will be, you know, gun rights advocates, the NRA, will no doubt turn people out in droves. I would imagine that you will see on the other side, gun control advocates, organized and not, showing up in large numbers. And we will really see this come to a head. And as you alluded to, this is a difficult issue for lawmakers. Even Democrats have been reluctant over the last 9 years that I've been here to go anywhere near this issue. And there, whether the sands are shifting, it's probably too early to say, but I'm sensing a level of support for a quote-unquote gun control measure that I have not seen in 9 years in my time down here. I'll just mention the police chiefs were down here a few years ago talking about closing the so-called gun show loophole, which would have been a narrower expansion of the background checks, and that didn't go anywhere, even with Democrats in control.
Very interesting. On education, Austin, at this point, at reading the tea leaves, are the Republicans putting more money into education up front?
Well, the Senate majority's rhetoric is basically reform before funding. They have not committed to a dollar amount around starting to fulfill or make a down payment on the Supreme Court ruling that the state is not adequately funding schools. Generally down here, that's thought to be $1 billion in the next 2 years. This new majority has been very reticent to name a number and instead said, quote unquote, we're going to pay for outputs and not just think about inputs. And so they've been putting forth some what they call reforms, giving letter grades to schools, retaining third graders who aren't passing their reading tests. Over in the House, they have proposed a Fund Education First measure that would put about $900 million towards the McCleary decision. And do that first. And the way you do that without also raising taxes is you've got to pull from other places. And there's not a lot of wiggle room in the budget. And so invariably where you're going to pull from is going to be in health and human services, social services, because those are the other big pieces of the budget. And, you know, perhaps higher ed, although I think that there's a keen desire on the part of both parties here to protect higher ed from additional cuts. But basically, if you're going to put more into education, you got to cut somewhere because there's about $1 billion shortfall.
Now, when I talked to Steve Litzo, he sounded loath to do that because he was saying, I understand that, you know, if we take care of young people and we have them have a healthy environment, they'll do better in school. But he sees the conundrum, right?
And that's very much the rhetoric of the Democrats, is that they don't like to, especially House Democrats, say you cannot view education in isolation and budget in isolation because, and they will say, and they say it every year, a kid's got to show up healthy to kindergarten in order to be able to do well in school. And so, for instance, children's health care is part and parcel of education kind of holistically or globally. So that's a difference, you know, between the parties, although you're alluding to the fact that Senator Lietzau, who is the chair of the Senate Education Committee and a Republican, seems to be using some of that same language. The reality is, Steve, it's very early in session. Nobody's written a budget yet. Everybody's waiting for the March revenue forecast. I mean, we're not even going to see a budget from the governor until then. And so until they know how much money they have to work with, whether the shortfall is bigger or smaller than what they think it is today, nobody really has to commit to anything other than some broad principles.
And that's what we're hearing, broad principles. By the way, what happened to the effort to end GET? Rodney Tom, the majority leader in the Senate, was pushing that. Then it seemed to be pushed off to somebody in committee. Is it dead?
Well, this is the Guaranteed Education Tuition Program, very popular, a lot of buy-in from the public. It's kind of a, you know, middle-class program that appeals broadly, and it's become a bit of a political football. Senator Rodney Tom has used it as an example of what he calls an unfunded long-term liability that he doesn't believe is a core function of state government. That said, you've got a lot of people already bought into the program. If you abandon it, that creates a whole bunch of fiscal implications. The latest testimony we heard was from the state actuary, who said basically if they freeze tuition for the next few years, they will actually solve the deficit in that program. My guess is that a popular program like this gets saved at the end of the day, but it's been held up as an example by Senator Tom and others that the state does do things in addition to the core functions. And the question then becomes, and it's a debate, I guess, that, you know, that ultimately voters will wrangle with as the years go by, what role should government play outside of putting people, you know, they call it educating them, incarcerating them, and you know, doing core functions, basically taking care of the most vulnerable.
How well have Democrats adapted to the Republican control in the Senate?
You can tell it's a painful new reality for them. In some respects, I think that the first couple of weeks, it was almost as if Democrats had not accepted it and were still acting like the majority. And as time passes, they are starting to move more into the sort of role of loyal opposition and fierce at times. But no, you can tell that this is difficult. The Democratic Party has, I guess, you know, censured Senators Tom and Shelton, the two Democrats who've crossed the aisle to join with Republicans to create this new majority. There are definitely some bruised feelings, some anger, and it's not a fun place for people like Senator Ed Murray, who thought he was going to be the majority leader of the Senate, to reside now, which is in the minority, and because two of his fellow Democrats decided to join ranks with Republicans.
Now, Austin, we heard a story this morning that you did a FOIA request to take a look at what meetings newly elected Governor Jay Inslee was having. He was spending a lot of time on pot, both in Washington and Washington, D.C., and with Oregon and other states adjacent. But given that, Governor Inslee seems quiet to me otherwise, and you're there. How does he compare to Chris Gregoire in her first weeks in office?
Well, you can't do a comparison because she came in, obviously, not even sure she was going to last very long herself because of a 129-vote margin in the end between she and Dino Rossi, that whole contested election. You know, it was sort of a mess. But it is a quiet start. We've seen one governor request bill from him. That last check, he had not signed any executive orders. We are expecting some sort of jobs package of legislation from him in the next few days. He has certainly held news conferences and talked about, for instance, Medicaid expansion. He's talked about the fact that he doesn't appreciate the direction the Senate is going with some changes to the injured workers system in the state. But this is definitely, it does feel different in terms of filling out his cabinet. We're still waiting to hear who his new Department of Transportation Secretary is going to be. It feels like a slow start to me as well. I think the pace may soon be about to pick up, but I also think you're talking about a governor who came from Congress, not somebody who is necessarily a creature of state government like Chris Gregoire was, and personality-wise, very, very different. So I think everybody's still trying to figure out the new governor and what his style will be, but it's, we're, as you said, 5 weeks in, and we haven't seen a lot yet.
All right. Well, we will track it with you. I appreciate you taking the time this morning, Austin.
You're welcome, Steve.
Austin Jenkins is Olympia correspondent. You can also see him on TVW. You can hear him on many public radio stations as well around the region. This is Weekday.
A linguist joins us to talk about grammar and the nature of language in a minute. KUOW 94.9 Seattle.
Support for KUOW comes from Annie Wright Schools. The day school serves boys and girls in preschool through grade 8, while the upper school offers all girls day and boarding programs for grades 9 through 12. Annie Wright is an international baccalaureate world school. More at a-w.org.
-47 degrees in Seattle with clouds and fog. Forecast says cloudy all day, chance of rain, a high of 49. Overnight, rain likely with a low of 43. Tomorrow, Wednesday, rain likely with a high of 48. I'm Bernard Ouellette. It's 9:21. Later this hour, we'll get a suggestion for a hike to match the week's weather. That's just about 35 minutes away.
When it comes to proper grammar, well, who decides? Who's issuing the citations? We're taking that up today. Jeffrey K. Pullum, look, you said gull and fool and not gull, and then I went and did the gull. Jeffrey K. Pullum is a linguist with a broad scholarly interest in language, especially the grammar of standard English. He's published over 200 articles and books ranging from technical syntactic theory to a study of language that he called the Great Eskimo Vocabulary Hoax. Apparently they don't have 350 words for snow, huh? Up there in the Northlands.
The Inuit have such a fascinating language that they have as many words as you might want, but not just for snow, for anything. It is an extraordinary kind of a language. And it pretty well makes this discussion of whether they have lots of words for snow meaningless. That's a pointless factoid. You can neither confirm it nor deny it, really. But the thing that's interested me about it always is that people keep saying this in magazine articles, and lazy writers just reach for this phrase. It is said the Eskimos have 391 words for snow. Well, here in Seattle, we should have hundreds of words for rain or something stupid like that. I've seen it dozens of times, maybe hundreds. And they're making these numbers up. They never go and consult a dictionary of Inuit or Yupik language. They just make numbers up to sound cleverer than they are by referring to Eskimo and languages. That's what made me think it was such a ridiculous thing.
Interested to learn that there are quite a few people working on Inuit, and these are many languages.
Oh, yeah.
Dictionaries across the whole region.
There are real Eskimologists who are...
Eskimologists.
Despite the story that the Inuit people don't really like to be referred to as Eskimos because that originates in an abusive term for them by... groups of Canadian Indians, I think. Linguists have come to know the whole language family as the Eskimoan family, and so they stick with that because you don't want to get confused. Inuit and Yupik languages are rather different, but they belong to a larger family, which we call Eskimoan. And there's real serious historical dictionaries of these languages that you can track stuff. You really can look stuff up on this. It's not like nobody knows what goes on up there in the Arctic. There are serious reference books. Nobody looks in them.
I know this is not your forte, but just last question on that. How have the languages evolved post-contact and mixing of peoples all across those areas? Do you know? I mean, English is evolved, French is evolved, right? I imagine the Eskimoan language.
Like any other language, these have evolved. And the Eskimos and Aleuts split about 3,000 or 4,000 years ago, and then Yupik and Inuit split about 1,000 to 2,000 years ago. And Greenlandic has split slightly from Canadian Inuit and so on. This happens to all languages. They gradually divide up, and separated populations develop new versions of the language. At first, it's just very, very modest, like American English and British English. But you leave it 500 years, and you get a separate languages. It's happening all the time, very slowly. It's not that you don't get cataclysmic changes in language that one day people wake up and they can hardly understand anybody. It happens very, very slowly and imperceptibly. But over a period of a few centuries, you get new languages developing, and that's just the same with Eskimoan or with Indo-European.
Jeffrey K. Pullum is our guest, a linguist, also the co-author of the Cambridge Grammar of the English Language, published in 2002. I was reading a BBC article about Airbnb, and they kept talking about lets. And I was, you know, it took me a little bit to know, oh, lets, rentals.
Yes.
Lets.
Right. The word let to be used as a count noun denoting a rental property.
Yeah. Not standard English in America.
That's right. But notice that's one tiny little divergence in which noun to use for a certain thing. It isn't a sort of big grammatical difference. It's a tiny little thing like the British calling trucks lorries. You notice it, but it's the most superficial kind of variation there could be. The remarkable thing to a linguist about American and British English is that there's essentially no difference at all at the level of grammatical structure. When you look at the syntax of how sentences are put together, the differences are utterly trivial, amazingly trivial, because you cannot keep 330 million Americans and 60 million Brits in line on any other domain. They don't agree on anything else, you know, but they have agreed down to a level of fine detail on the syntax of their sentences, and that's been constant over 200, 300 years.
Do you know if that's the case also with Spanish in South America and Spain?
I don't know a lot about Spanish, but I think English has got a unique status because of the extent to which it is a global lingua franca. It really is spread around the world much more than any other language.
All right, you wrote an article in the Chronicle Review, 2009, 50 years of stupid grammar advice.
Oh, yes.
April 16th was the 50th anniversary in 2009 of the publication of the little book, Strunk and White's Elements of Style. Admired by academics, not by you?
No, I despise it. And I got hate mail when I said so. I seem to have been unkind enough to say so on the 50th anniversary of its publication. Perhaps I should have waited for some other day. Yeah, it's a horrible little book. And I think it's guilty of a lot of sins. It is. It just spreads myths about English and keeps them alive and has done so for much closer to 100 years now than most people realize.
What are your complaints?
Almost everything they say about grammar as such is just flat out wrong. And the stuff that they say about style is worth saying, but it hardly needs a book. It hardly needs uttering at all. Yes, you shouldn't be vague and bombastic and obscure and wordy. You should try to say what needs to be said and keep it tight and clear. Of course, everybody agrees you want to be clear and you don't want to pother on with needless extra words. Is that all they have for us? You know. But no, they're treated as a little Bible of exactly which expressions are the good ones and which are the bad ones. And they're wrong on just about everything they say about the syntax of
sentences. Give me some examples.
Well, they actually assert that when you take a noun phrase like none of us or none of them, it has to have singular agreement. You must say none of us is interested. And that none of us are interested is wrong. And that's just flat out not true. And the really interesting thing is, I mean, I won't go on about it because I'm going to explore that a little bit in my lecture tonight at the university. The truth is, it isn't true now, and it wasn't true 100 years ago when Strunk was a young man.
Well,
50 years ago when E.B. White.
Where did the assertion come from?
They seem to have made it up. Or else they have derived it mistakenly from some feeling of logic that none of us must mean no individual one of us, and one should be singular, surely. So they sort of reason their way mistakenly to the conclusion that it ought to be singular. Whereas what you've actually got to do with natural languages, since these are not logic systems, is listen to how the expert users use the language and take that as your guide. If the rules of the language don't ultimately come from the ways in which the most expert users have deployed the language to say the things they've said, then they can't come from anywhere. The rules of English grammar don't come from God. They don't come from Congress. They don't come from outer space.
Do they come from grammar people like yourself?
No, grammar people shouldn't be stipulating, I recommend this, you ought to do that, and so on. It's just a mistake about their role. The principles of grammar that are the really interesting ones, the ones that really do guide the way the language works, stem ultimately from the people who use the language, the people who know it, the people who write in it. Certainly the expert ones, like broadcasters and authors and journalists and so on. These are the experts, and ultimately English grammar resides with them, and the way they use the language is the way it is. What other source could there be?
English is changing, Jeffrey Pullum, and it's changing in part because, you know, there's many people from many places speaking English with their own idiosyncrasies, and some of that is even slang, and we hear that in hip-hop, we hear it in from Jamaica, that those English languages are also asserting themselves in the broader sphere. Is that, and they have different grammatical constructions, is that just the natural evolution of the language, right?
I'd say it's hardly on the radar screen. I really don't.
Of language?
I don't think slang is a big feature of language at all. Again, it seems to be salient because grown-ups who hear the odd slang expression just, you know, once a day is enough to get their hackles up, and they notice it, and it reminds them that there are awful things about kids today. But it really is not a feature of the scene. You know, I've been up for quite a few hours, and I've talked to quite a few people today, various walks of life, starting in the deli at 6 o'clock in the morning. I haven't heard any hip-hop slang today. It's not a general feature of what's happening in the language. Just these occasional little phrases that come out of, say, pop music, and a few people use them now and then. Young people using them to annoy middle-aged people.
But it hasn't.
Occasional middle-aged people using them to try and sound cool, which is a big mistake. But this is a trivial contribution to the totality of the language. It's hardly there at all.
How has language changed, the English language changed, in terms of rules, in terms of syntactical rules, for example?
Incredibly little, even over a century. It really isn't a noticeable feature of the language that it's different today from 100 years ago. And you shouldn't really expect it to, because like any other language, it has speakers whose birth dates range over the whole of a century. There are some people around who can speak this language who are 102 years old, and others who can also speak it a little bit who are only 2 years old. So you shouldn't expect much change over periods less than 100 years. And certainly there isn't much. And what there is tiny little increments or decrements of which words are in common use, little tiny expressions and so on. Oh, an interesting one that somebody who's not a linguist pointed out to me the other day is using why as the first word of a sentence that's not a why question. She'd actually noticed a novel in which a character in his 20s said, "Are you free for lunch?" And the response of his friend was, "Why, yes." And she noticed immediately that's not how we talk. Saying, "Why, yes, I am," that's at least 50 years ago. You know, nobody says that today. Little things like that change. And they're the ones that people catch on to because they're noticeable, and they, despite being tiny, they seem indicative, significant.
All right, well, here's my grammar police emails then that I've gotten. Jeffrey Pullum, just on that notion. Is there a website that lists the 10 most common spoken grammar mistakes? If all professional broadcasters memorized that list, the number of their mistakes on the air would go way down. Two that annoy me are very unique. There's many examples of bad grammar on KUOW. Singular verb, plural subject. Nobody likes to say there are, it seems. Nobody's perfect, but standards are definitely sliding. There you go.
Yes, there are lots of such stupid lists on the internet, and they're all junk. The peeves that people have are usually completely unmotivated. Let's take the business of nobody says there are. What's going on here is, when you speak really formally or when you write, you distinguish there is one person from there are three people. But when you speak informally, you reduce there is to theirs. And there is a general tendency to let theirs stand for there are as well. So in speech, you can use there's three things wrong with this. Everybody does that. It's perfectly fine. And curious fact is that it's rather like a fact about colloquial Arabic, where if the verb is before the subject, it doesn't agree with the subject. If the verb is after the subject, which is another word order possibility, then it does agree. That's just what's going on in standard English here. But this is standard English. It's not a mistake. It's just a natural feature of language to develop little differences like this in where you use agreement and where you don't. And the remarkable thing is that people are so upset by these tiny little things they've noticed that they will send emails to radio stations about them. No, most people who speak on the radio have an astonishing ability to be fluent and grammatical all day long. Not necessarily interesting, but fluent and grammatical. And
boom, he slid it in there. Did you see that? He was going for the compliment, then boom, right underneath.
This is the fact. I think Rush Limbaugh seems to be on about 4 hours a day. And
one sentence.
He's continually nasty and often illogical, but broadly, he is speaking fluent standard English and he doesn't make grammatical mistakes. And you can't just pick up on these silly little nitpicky things like, you're objecting to the notion of something being very unique and think that that's a grammar error. You're just being a sort of logical nitpicker if you say that the adjective unique couldn't be qualified by any adverbs because uniqueness is so unique. It's sometimes true, it sometimes isn't. But there's no problem with saying something that is almost unique. That means not that there's only one of it, but there's hardly any of it. And it's close to one. It's coherent.
You know, I was enjoying, just to end this, I was enjoying reading the language log, your blog, where you put things down, other mm-hmm. people put things down too. And, of course, the comments that come afterwards. You must get you must be inundated with emails from the grammar police.
Yes, I've decided.
All self-deputized, by the way.
I've decided it's better to be inundated with emails that I can occasionally answer if I have the time and they're interesting enough, and ignore if they're just abuse. But I have taken to shutting down the comments area on my language log posts because it's not actually the nastiness. I can handle nasty. But it's the dumb ones that haven't read what I wrote and didn't listen and so on. I hate devoting a quarter of an hour to doing a careful argument for an interesting case that such and such is not true. Some proposition P is actually false, though widely believed, and then finding that the commenters who haven't read to the end of what I wrote are saying, oh, you don't realize that P. Yes, I realize that you think that P, and I just explained carefully why it's not true, and I thought it was rather clever, and here you are just reasserting it. It pains me to deal with things like that. People these days on blogs hit the I'm going to comment on this button before they've even got to the bottom of the first screen. They're not paying attention, and I don't want to pay attention to people who aren't paying attention. I mean, it's my choice. It's my life, and I'm blogging for free on LanguageLog. I just don't want to spend time dealing with that. So I'm afraid I'm not quite one of these people who believes that every blog has got to be about a conversation. I choose who I converse with, and I don't want to converse with the whole world at the same time. Everybody just all come on at me. I read quality magazines like The Economist is my favorite, and I notice they devote a page to letters to the editor, but they don't print every letter they've ever received that week and hundreds of pages of them from anybody, whether they're even spelled correctly or whether they're abusive. They choose. And as I see LanguageLog, it would be better to have the discussion a little bit moderated. But I haven't got time to moderate it, so I just switch the off button. That's all.
I hope that people turn up in droves to listen to what you have to say. Tonight at 6:30 at Kane Hall, standing room only. See, now you could just not nitpick, but pull apart every little bit of language. Standing room only, one of my favorite phrases. Jeffrey Pullum is a linguist, broad scholarly interest in language. He is the co-author of the Cambridge Grammar of the English Language, 1,860 pages, looking at the linguistic structure of standard English. That was a little bit of work. All right, sir, thank you very much. I appreciate it.
Thank you, Steve.
This is Weekday.
By the way, if you like thinking about language and playing with words, you might want to tune into KUOW on Saturday evenings.
What's the difference between perfume and cologne? Is Fern, F-I-R-N, a tool used in glassblowing or old gritty snow? Share in the wonder of the English language each week by tuning into Says You, the game of wit and wordplay. I'm Richard Schur, inviting you to play along and laugh along on Says You from NPR.
Saturday night at 6 o'clock on KUOW 94.9 Seattle.
Support for KUOW comes from Chaplin's Bellevue Subaru, committed to safety. Subaru Engineering features stability control and braking, crash protection systems, and child safety. Chaplin's Bellevue Subaru at I-90 and Eastgate or chaplinssubaru.com.
Forty-eight degrees in Seattle with clouds and fog. Forecast says it's going to be cloudy all day with a chance of rain and a predicted high of 49.
Support for KUOW comes from Alaska USA Federal Credit Union. For over three generations, Alaska USA members have shared the goal of helping each other get places worth going with savings accounts, loans, investments, insurance policies, and more. On the web at alaskausa.org.
I'm Bernard Ouellette. It's 9:43. We're going to hear some firsthand stories of traveling through Myanmar on a bicycle just about 40 minutes from now, this morning at 10:20.
But first, top officials are testifying this morning to the Senate Armed Services Committee about the impact of budget uncertainty on the nation's military.
It would be immoral to use the force unless it's well-trained, well-led, and well-equipped.
Are we on the path to creating that dilemma for future commanders?
We are on that path.
That's Joint Chiefs Chairman General Martin Dempsey responding to Senator Lindsey Graham at a Senate Armed Services Committee meeting this morning. You're listening to Weekday. I'm Steve Scher. As you heard, military leaders have been warning of a readiness crisis if automatic spending cuts slice into defense spending on March 1st. The sequester would cut $1.2 trillion in spending through 2021, with the largest chunk of that coming from defense,
Pentagon budget planners are also operating under a continuing budget resolution. So the sequester hasn't happened yet, but the military is already curbing spending and forestalling civilian hires. Tom Philpott writes the military update column that appears in newspapers around the country and at militaryupdate.com. Tom Philpott, thanks for talking to us.
My pleasure, Steve. Thanks for having me.
You heard General Dempsey from earlier this morning. How serious are these cuts?
They're very serious. They're very deep, and they come on top of the services already trying to handle $487 billion in cuts over 10 years. This would be another, for this year alone, $46 billion, and that would be on top of a continuing resolution that froze spending below last year's level of spending. So the services are trying to handle a very significant cut already, and another one is to occur March 1st.
A little bit of explanation about how we got here. Why are we at the point of a sequester? And for that matter, why is there a continuing resolution rather than a budget for the Pentagon?
Well, I guess you might just describe it as budget havoc over the past couple of years as the Congress has strived to but failed to address the nation's debt crisis. And they tied it, of course, to the raising the debt ceiling. And to get an agreement to raise the debt ceiling 2 years ago, they passed the Budget Control Act that had this sequestration threat built in it, that if you do not come up with a plan to reduce the debt by $1.2 trillion, then you'll have to go to automatic cuts in defense budget and automatic cuts in non-discretionary items of the budget. And then they excluded from that agreement the prized Social Security, Medicare, and so forth spending that really most critics of federal spending say is where our real out-of-control costs are. So Congress came up with this crazy sequestration thing, and I say crazy, and that's not my words. Everyone is calling it mindless, stupid, anything you can think of. But it turns out that the Congress doesn't have the leadership skills to get themselves out of what they voted for.
Tom Philpott writes the military update column. Appears in newspapers around the country and at militaryupdate.com. All right, Tom Philpott, since you offered that opinion, let me just respond with this as a question.
Sure.
We have a huge budget in the Defense Department.
Yes.
Far and away higher than the rest of the world. We want to see, some people say we need to see some cuts over time. Why? I know that the argument against the sequester in part is it's just across the board, and if it wasn't across the board, Pentagon leaders could make more intelligent cuts, cutting back programs that don't work, keeping money in programs that do work. But overall, don't we face the need to cut Pentagon as well as these other, and then we'll get to entitlements in a minute, but don't we face the need to cut the Pentagon back? We're ending two wars. We're dealing with a new world.
Yes, we absolutely do. But there is more. There is a lot to be said about the criticism that you raised, that the way the sequestration would do it. It really shows a vacuum of leadership by the Congress. But there are two issues here. One is, as you described it, the concurrent receipt, the freezing of accounts at how they spent on programs in 2012. You know, our fiscal budget year for 2013 began in October. Congress failed to pass a new appropriations bill for the new year, so they kept it under a continuing resolution that really set spending a little below what it was last year. But the services had continued to spend as though the Congress, as it has in other years, passed just a late appropriations bill. They decided by January that they would not get an appropriations bill at all this year, and that's their fear. And so they were already spending money that they didn't, in effect, have. So that made the hole deeper. And you'll appreciate this, Steve, I think, that there are dollars that spend quickly and dollars that spend slowly. If you're building a ship, you don't pay for the ship all at one time. You pay for it in increments as the work gets done. So the money that really spends out quickly is your training dollars and your to operate your bases and to maintain your equipment, those are the dollars that are really feeling the pinch right now. And so by not passing a new authorization, the services find themselves without those immediate spend dollars that they need to complete the rest of the year's obligations for training and readiness.
Now, I know this is a separate issue and a controversial issue, but, I mean, I guess you could point to what happened apparently somehow in response to Benghazi or in the way the State Department was being served by the military in terms of security, where Secretary Clinton came before the Congress and said, look, you guys cut our readiness programs, and that's part of the reason we had this problem.
Right, and that of course, the State Department budget. What we have here is the Defense Department budget, and I think what the service leaders fear now is that the kind of hard choices that committee members would like to make with regard to defense budget, the authorizing committees, that's the Armed Services Committees, and the appropriators, the Defense Appropriations Committee, they're not going to get to make the decisions on where these dollars are going to be spent. If they don't pass an appropriations bill, it'll be up to the services to try to accommodate where they take these cuts. And I think the fear is that the Armed Services Committees are, in fact, handcuffed, almost frozen out of this process, because what's happening is the debt crisis is not being resolved by the White House, by the president, and it's not being resolved by the leadership, the House Speaker and the Senate Majority Leader. So they are failing to make the kind of decisions and negotiations they need to make, and therefore the Armed Services Committee, who have a greater stake in what happens to defense budgets, are almost powerless.
Well, I brought up the Secretary Clinton statement in part. I understand the State Department budget, but it's about how decisions in Congress made for various reasons start to affect what's happening on the ground. With the president expected to talk about withdrawing more troops from Afghanistan, what impact does that have on the budget discussion or the budget?
Well, I think if he draws down faster than has been planned, and we're waiting for that decision today, it looks like about half of the troops that we have over there in Afghanistan will be gone a year from now. The more you reduce your tip of the spear out there in a war zone, I guess the easier it is to accommodate more slim budget coming from the Congress. But so I don't see that drawdown has a great effect. The services, the Army and the Marine Corps were expecting by the year 2017 to have 80,000 fewer troops than they have today. That's already built into the budget. But we're talking about sequestration will make these automatic cuts across 2,500 separate programs, most of them for modernization, to build, to replace aircraft, to replace ships, and to modernize our forces and keep them modern. They would cut about 9% out of every one of those programs, whether or not the one program has a greater priority than another program. That's the challenge that this sequestration mechanism has set up.
So, Tom Philpott, what's your best guess today? What's going to happen March 1st?
I don't think they will reach an agreement. I think this Congress is so paralyzed by a vacuum of leadership that sequestration will go into effect March 1st, and then we'll just see how painful it really is for the services. The services have each come up with a list of what's going to happen if they are forced to operate under a continuing resolution the rest of this fiscal year, which would be through September. And if sequestration requires them to take another $46 billion in cuts the rest of the year. There's some debate, as you can imagine, Steve, among think tanks who are more liberal in looking at defense budgets. They are saying, you know, the services say that they will have to do this draconian cut and that draconian cut, when a lot of those dollars might be able to be squeezed out of service contracts. For example, the folks who who cut the lawns and maintain the bases and so forth, who are civilians, those contracts might disappear. Maybe you'll have soldiers cutting the lawns instead. But the question is how much there really is to squeeze from that kind of decision, a budget decision changes. The services are saying that this will be the deepest defense cuts they've experienced, certainly in a wartime situation, which we still have going on.
All right, sir, I appreciate you talking to us. Tom Philpott writes the Military Update column in newspapers around the country and at militaryupdate.com. Thank you.
Thank you, Steve.
And by the way, we'll try to talk to one of those think tankers that Tom Philpott was mentioning tomorrow on Weekday.
And now, the sound of the day.
That's the sound of Weekday listener Amy and her family snowshoeing Hurricane Ridge on Groundhog's Day. She says the walk was led by a ranger who explained the winter ecosystem of the mountain as they walked, who hibernated where, what critters stayed awake, moving all winter. And all the while, the hikers peeled off layer upon layer of clothing as the sun broke through the cloud layer. Amy says that it was so beautiful up there, they went back yesterday to go tubing. Another beautiful wintry day in the mountains, which Michael Fagan likes to think about. Brings us a weather forecast and a hike to match the weather. West Coast Weather LLC and hikewashington.net. That sounded familiar to you, didn't it, Michael?
That did. I thought maybe someone was following me this past Sunday.
Where did you go?
We went out to Slippery Creek, round two, just east of Enumclaw off of Highway 410. I call it round two because we went there November several months ago. We had skis and snowshoes. We're all set to go, and there's no snow, so we walked on dirt all day. Still fun. So we went back on Sunday, and we couldn't even get to the gate. There was plenty of snow, so that was fun. The first 2 miles were very hard snow, so if you're thinking of doing skis, be forewarned of that. But after 2 miles, once you got 4 miles into the trip, the snow was soft. We snowshoed, but you can certainly ski that. We snowshoed about, like I said, 4 miles and gained 2,000 feet. So that's a reasonable type of mileage. And if you're looking for views, Friday at this point looks like the best day because today and Wednesday will be cloudy to partly cloudy. And if you go Friday, you'll get some views of Mount Rainier and a lot of the snow-covered peaks in the area. And for this hike, it's Green Trail Maps 238, and you'll need that Hancock permit to access that area. So that's what I have in store for this week. And, you know, you mentioned those guided tours by the Forest Service.
Yeah.
I put a link on my blog. Stevens Pass and Snoqualmie Pass during the winter have guided snowshoe trips. Some of them just a little bit over an hour, some of them a half day, and they also have one on winter ecology and photography. So that might also be fun this upcoming weekend.
You also have the Hike Washington, at hikewashington.net, you also have the HancockRecreationNorthwest.com link so people can get those passes. And you have some beautiful pictures. This looked like it was a great day.
Yeah, Sunday was a banner day. And keep your fingers crossed. Friday looks nice as far as the sun. Maybe Saturday, but that's a little bit too far off in the forecast picture. So I'm sure you'll give people a nice note to get off Friday if the sunny conditions come to fruition, right?
I would give them a note, except I will have to get a note myself if the sunny. Jason will give me a note maybe, or Bernard. Bernard will give me a note.
I was going to ask your grammar police. I wanted some extra words for cloudy to partly cloudy. That's what we have the next couple days. And any rainfall will be on the light side. And today we might even get a little sunbreak in the city. So there you have it. Highs low 50s. Up at Snoqualmie Pass, highs about 40 degrees.
All right. Sounds good. Good hiking to you, sir.
Same to you.
Michael Fagan is at West Coast Weather LLC, where they
suggest hikes. Well, they take work for people who are hiking around the world, and he suggests hikes to us. You can find information at hikewashington.net. We have a link at our website, kuow.org. Information about the Hancock Pass is at his website as well. Stay with us. Willie Weir is going to take us to Myanmar, and we're also going to head into the chat room, talk about music, the Grammys, and its influence on the culture.
46 degrees in Seattle with a predicted high today of 49. Forecast says cloudy with a chance of rain.
Support from Carbonite Computer Backup.
It's been many years since South Africa held its Truth and Reconciliation Commission.
Thanks for listening. The program you just heard was made possible by the financial support of our listeners. Support this program and others like it by making a pledge today at kuow.org.